Accession number 27272, Mr. Malcolm Frost, Rear 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Frost?
I was born in a small village in South Norfolk, East Harling, on the 7th of May 1933.
And could you tell us a little about your family background?
Well, my father was, in the early years, he was a ganger working with the trainees who had come down from the northeast during the Depression when they set up the labour camps. After that, he worked on one of the larger estates near Thetford. There were three of us in the three children in the family, a sister and a brother, both older than me. My sister was still alive. My brother, unfortunately, dropped dead at the age of 20 playing football because we have heart conditions which run in the family. Lived in a small village, and during the war years,
hang on a minute. Were the family comfortably off with your dad being a ganger?
No, my father was... We were very poorly off, to be honest. Came from a very poor family. I think my father's wage, if I remember rightly, was 28 shillings a week, which, even in those days, was a pittance.
What sort of house were you in?
We lived in a small cottage originally. Then, at the age of four or thereabouts, we were moved into a modern council house.
Still in East Harling.
Built in 1936, because we were a five-person family, three children, a mother and father, in a one-bedroom cottage, originally. It's interesting that what would be seen as a modern council house in 1936 had an outside earth closet. We had a sink in the kitchen which wasn't connected to any form of drainage, so it was never used. It had a draining board of which my father stood his wireless on, and I remember sitting around that wireless listening to the declaration of war in 1939. So we were, I would say, coming from a very poor family.
Now, what about your education? That would just have started before the war.
I started at primary school at the age of four. Fortunately, mother had taught me how to read and write before I went to school. Went to the small village school, and during the war years, we were surrounded by army camps, both American and English. And of course, there were all the airfields around. Snetterton was the nearest.
I'll come back to the war. What was your education like? Take us through to your education, ignoring the war for a minute. What was your education like at the school?
It was a small primary school with, in those days, I mean, people leaving school at the age of 14. There was an infant class, which was 4 to about 6. There was an intermediate class, which was 7 to about 11. And then there was a senior class, which was the children from 10 or 11 upwards to age 14, which was leaving age. So there were three teachers and just three rooms in the school. I always remember about the school, it was we had scaffolding inside because the ceiling was a bit dodgy, and actually we worked amongst scaffolding poles.
So it was only a small school?
Small school, yeah. Small village. The village was, in those days, about 700 strong, I think, in terms of numbers.
And what was it, a good education? Were there good teachers? Was it? I mean, you've got a good start.
We had some good teachers. We had a very good headmaster, a chap called William Beaumont Slegg. He was very interested in history, so we had a lot of history in the school. But all the teachers were excellent, and the schooling prior to going to grammar school, I couldn't fault. I was lucky in that perhaps being a bit, I won't say more intelligent than some, but destined to eventually have a grammar school education. I tended to be with children older than myself. I was in standard 6 and 7 before the age of 11. So I was actually working with 14-year-olds. But I took 11 plus in 44 and passed it, and I got a free place in Thetford Grammar School.
Now, what was that like? That's quite a well-known school.
It was a small school. 190 was the role. It was originally a fee-paying school. When I went, there was a number of still fee-paying pupils left, but most of the 36 who were in the first form I was in were non-fee-paying. The top six places you got without interview, if you got what they call one of the free places, you didn't have to attend school for an interview. Others who passed 11 plus actually were interviewed to see whether they were suitable to go to grammar school or not. But I didn't need to go for an interview. I know my mother had a struggle to find enough clothing coupons to keep me in uniform, because it wasn't easy in those days. I think she used to even buy some coupons from other people to make sure one was clothed. And she worked on the land to keep me at school. For that, I was eternally grateful.
Now, what was Thetford Grammar School like as a school for you?
Excellent school. I was there from 44 to 51. It gave me not only a first-class education, but it also taught me hell of a lot about life. We had some very good teachers, and one in particular who really, well, he was the English master, and quite frankly, he taught us about life and what we could expect from life, basically.
In what way? What sort of lessons?
He taught us the value of sportsmanship, the value of comradeship, the value of having a good education, the value of applying yourself and doing the best that you could, even if you had limited ability in some areas. And I think he alone was instrumental, I think, in formulating my character in those early formative years.
Now, how did you do it? What subjects did you like or not like?
I liked most subjects. I tended to be more on the art than the scientific side. I worked through to school certificate level, obviously, in 1949, and I was caught between the period of the old school certificate and the new GCSE stroke, and the old A-levels disappeared. Sorry, the old higher school certificate disappeared. So I took the old old school certificate, but the new advanced levels. And I was took that in the first year, and I think it was somewhat experimental as well. Certainly the marking seemed to be somewhat experimental.
You didn't do as well as you'd hoped then?
I got a first class school certificate with exemption from London matriculation. I went to sixth form. I think my 2 years in sixth form, taking the new A-levels, I probably did not enough academically, because I was head boy, I was captain of football, I edited the school magazine, and I don't think I perhaps devoted as much time to scholastic things as I should have done. I actually had an interview for a place at Fitzwilliam at Cambridge, and one at Nottingham University, and I would have got to either, I think, if my A-level results had been better. I passed a couple of subjects, but I didn't do as well as I should have done to get to university.
Well, we'll come back to where you go to next. Let's just go back to the war years, so I kept the education all together.
Yeah.
Now, what about the outbreak of war? I mean, you were only, what, six?
I was six, yeah.
It's really a child's perspective of the war we're looking at.
Yeah.
What did you remember? I mean, you said you remember listening to
the... I remember sitting listening to the broadcast from by Chamberlain.
What do you remember? What did you think?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, I know... My parents were sort of looking on with trepidation, basically, what was happening in the world. I wasn't really perhaps old enough to really understand what was going on, but it was made very clear to me that it was going to be a fairly rough period. My father was not going to go in the army because he was in a reserved occupation. But I think my life really in the village now then revolved around what we saw of military and the Americans.
Now, what do you remember? I mean, what effects did the war have on you?
We didn't get bombed, but we did have quite a few aircraft sort of falling about us from the sky when they came back to Snetterden and some of the other airfields, because the village I lived in was ringed by both British and American airfields.
And what do you remember of the aircraft? These are British aircraft crashing on the way home.
Yeah, British and American flying forces at Snetterton, Liberators they had, Wellington bombers at Watton. We had various plane crashes around. I remember going to seeing a Mustang, an American fighter, go down in the woods, and as typical kids we got on our bikes and cycled to see what we could find, and I think that was my first experience of seeing body parts sort of hanging in trees, and I think that was a bit of a rude awakening as to what war was all about. There was also a German prisoner of war camp in the village, a small one, which was covered by the Americans.
Do you have any contact with the German?
Only when they came through the village on the... They used to handle all the garbage and rubbish from the American camp, and they used to come through the village on a lorry with their guards, and we always used to sort of give them a bit of a rough time when they came through. We thought we were doing the right thing for the cause. But we had a lot of contact with the Americans, and the adjacent to the school was what was then the village hall, and that was taken over and commandeered by the army, and that was their cookhouse and also their sort of hall.
The Americans?
No, they were the British.
How
British
did you
army.
Get on with the British and the American soldiers? You know,
fine. The British, there's hall next to school. In fact, they used to have visiting ends of concert parties. Those little story might amuse you or not. And although we were only kids, we used to go to these concerts on occasions, and we were allowed to sit in the front in what was then the village hall. Some of the people who came, particularly comedians, some of their stories were somewhat risque. We didn't understand them because we were not old enough to understand the innuendo and double entendre, but our headmaster got to hear that we were going to these concerts, which were less than perhaps savoury in his opinion. So on one occasion he turned up with his wife and they sat in the front row, and from thereafter we were banned from going to the concerts. We never did really understand why, because I still remember some of the jokes, but no, we got on well with both the Americans and the British.
How did they treat you? I mean, were they friendly?
Excellent. The Americans in particular, I went to a Methodist chapel. I was also at church, but we found the Methodist chapel had a better youth club, and we used to take, well, not concerts, but choirs round the American camps, and I used to sing sometimes solo with a cousin. We used to sing duets, and they really were very good to us. I mean, they fed us well. We had sweets from them. And my family, my mother and father, were befriended by a coloured American officer who used to come to ours for, I think to be with the family, basically. The atmosphere between the coloured and the white Americans was unbelievable.
In what way? Were you aware of that? Even
very much aware of it. In fact, at one point, I know for a fact that where they were encamped, which was very close to the village station, that there were often fights between the blacks and the whites, the coloureds and the whites, stone throwing and all sorts of things like that. They just apparently did not see eye to eye. The lieutenant who used to come to my mother's, and the coloured lieutenant who used to bring some sweets from the PX and so on, it was made very clear to him that he wasn't expected to mix with white families, and that sort of terminated the friendship my mother had, mother and father had with him, which was sad. But all in all, I mean, the Americans looked after us kids extremely well.
What about the rationing, food and clothing rationing? How much impact did that have on you?
I've mentioned clothing. My mother found it hard to keep me in proper school clothes. But she used to buy coupons, I think, from people. Food-wise, being in the country, of course, my father had moved during the war to working on the estate, and he was what was termed a warrener. You know the expression, keeping down the rabbit population. And so we had plenty of meat because we always had rabbits, and somehow pheasants used to walk into his traps. But the meat ration, I think, was only about 1 threepence. I think most people thought meat ration was on weight, but I believe it was on money, and if you bought cheaper cuts, you could get more of it. Being an agricultural worker, Dad always got an extra cheese ration. I think he got 12 ounces of cheese a week, which was more than the normal ration of 2 ounces or so. But we were reasonably well fed, and I suppose bread and dripping was one of our sort of favourite meals.
Now, did you follow the progress of the war? I mean, probably not much at 6, but you rise into 11 and 12.
Most certainly we did. We always kept in touch with what was going on.
And what was the main medium?
By radio, wireless, as we called it. We didn't have an electric wireless. It was a high tension battery with an accumulator. And we had a local electrical people who lived sort of about 5 or 6 miles away, used to come on a regular weekly basis and bring a newly charged accumulator for the wireless. We all sat around the wireless in the evenings listening to the news and the papers. So even in that age, we kept abreast of what was happening.
Did you have any relatives that you followed in particular, you know, uncles or anything?
I had no, what I would call, very close relatives. I had an uncle in the army. I had an uncle on my mother's side who was out in Singapore at the time of the Japanese, I think, invasion. We had friends of the family who were taken prisoner of war and so on, so we basically sort of kept in touch in that way with what was going on. But family-wise, we never had any great impact on my own family as such.
Now, anything else about the war, effects of the war on you or your family?
In the village, we had Italian prisoners of war who were quite freely working on the farms. So some of those were quite pleasant individuals. In fact, 2 or 3 of them actually stayed after the war. And one of them actually married a local girl and stayed on in the village. I think we learned a lot of what was going on. I mean, I know perhaps this isn't something that you might find that perhaps one should say, but prostitutes used to come down quite regularly by train to the village to visit local camps. And I think as youngsters in our sort of, I mean, I was 9 at the beginning of the war, 6 at the beginning of the war, and 9, 10, 12 when it finished, 12 when it finished. So I think our sexual education was quite extended by the activities of what went on around the village, to be honest. Kids, I suppose, we thought that was quite something to find out about the happenings of what went on between ladies and gentlemen.
Now, getting back onto the thing, so leaping forward again to when you left school, your grades weren't good enough for the two universities. So what were you going to do? This is 1951, isn't it?
I had two choices. I could go to teacher training college, or I could go and do my national service. In fact, what Fitzwilliam had said to me was that even if I'd gone to Fitzwilliam, they would not have accepted me straight from school. The old boy there, who was the, I don't know what they call him, the gaffer of the college, he was a First World War veteran, and he'd been wounded in a tank during the First World War. And when I had my interview, I told him that if I did my national service, I thought I'd like to go in the educational corps, and his reaction was, "That's a fun call. Get out and join something like the infantry," or, and he said, "Come back in 2 years' time and and then we'll take you on. So I would have had a place if my results had been satisfactory, but they weren't. I passed my Latin, and which you had to have for Cambridge. But it was basically because of the lack of attention to academic detail rather than sort of service.
Did you go into work or did you go to national service?
I went into temporarily worked on the estate where Dad worked in Lord Musker's estate near Thetford.
And
working in the fields, feeding cows, sugar beet harvesting.
So as an agricultural labourer.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is just temporary.
Yeah, I mean, I worked there during my school holidays when I was old enough, age of 15 to time I was 18, because, I mean, one had to work during school holidays to earn some money to really see you through school. Yes, that's what they did until I was called up in October.
You called up October 9. What was the process of being called? That's October 51.
Yeah, October 51.
What was the process?
Well, I got my calling up papers, which I reported for a medical and was past fit to be called up. I gave my preferences as Education Corps and whatever else there was available, but found myself called up to the Royal Norfolks at Britannia Barracks in Norwich.
And that was October?
October 51, yeah.
And how did you react to being called up, you and your family?
I think my parents were a bit concerned, I think, as to what was going to happen to me, particularly as the Korean War was on. But I didn't at one moment think I would go to Korea. I'd not led a sheltered life, but I hadn't had much exposure to the world, if you like, because in those days there was fairly in the way of school trips and things. I think I had one school trip the whole time I was at grammar school, and that was in the last year when we had the local chief education officers to take youngsters from the different grammar schools to Lake District and so on. And that was the only time I'd really been away from home. So I was a little bit sort of wary as to what was going to happen. But then when I joined up and found the enormous spectrum of people that were brought together. In our intake, I can remember we had Bishop Herbert's son, who was then the Bishop of Norwich. He was in the intake. And the other end of the spectrum, there was a young lad from the East End of London who was in Borstal and who'd finished, well, I think at that time you were given the opportunity of either completing Borstal or you went into national service. And so he came into national service at the age of 18 from Borstal. And that was the sort of spectrum of people who I joined up with.
Now, what was your reception when you arrived? You went to Britannia Barracks,
yeah,
in October,
yeah,
of 1951.
Yeah.
Now, you arrive as a civilian, basically, don't you?
That's right.
And what happens is you go through, it's still there, it's not a barracks anymore.
It's a prison, part of the prison.
What happened when you got there?
I was given a warrant to go to train, I remember, and made my way up there. There was some fun I met up with others, young lads in civvies, but within a very short time I realised that we were going to be told exactly what we were going to do and how to do it. So we were sort of taken on board fairly quickly and taken to the stores and having all the kit sort of thrown at us in our various sizes.
What were you kitted out with?
Kitted out with everything.
What was it?
Uniformed battle dress, working dress, denims, kit bag, small pack, shirts, vests, underpants, socks, tin helmet, everything that one had sort of as a squaddie. The only thing we weren't given initially was a rifle, which I thought they probably looked a bit too dangerous.
And did the uniform fit?
Yes, the beret, I think, was always a problem. But no, yeah, it fitted reasonably, and the boots, they found the right size. So, yeah, I think that in main, I think some of us looked a bit of a ragbag, but in the main, they fitted reasonably well.
Now, what was your barrack room? You were in the barrack. It's the old barrack.
Yeah, yeah. There were two. The intake was split into two platoons, named after original Norfolk VCs.
Now, which one were you?
Randall and Gristock, and I was in Gristock platoon. So the intake was split sort of in two halves. Sergeant we had was Sergeant Hudson, lovely chap.
I'll come up. What about the room? What was it like?
It's a large upstairs barrack room. Beds down both sides. I think there was, not exactly remember the number in the room, but it must have been somewhere in the region of 24 or thereabouts. I think it was about 12 a side. Just a bed, a locker, bed with a mattress and blankets, which had to be folded in a particular fashion every morning.
Any heating? Because it's October.
Yeah, we had a tortoiseshell stove, I remember, in the middle of the room, which was coke fired, and we had the same fit for heating later on in continuation training. We had to clean the broom handles with razor blades to make sure they were always kept absolutely white. Well, not white, but the raw wood. Then we went into basic training, basically.
Well, we look at basic normally by taking a typical day and there's let everything spin off it, you know.
Yeah.
But, I know there's no such thing, but, I mean, what time would your day start?
Reveille was 6 o'clock. Up and sort of ablutions, cold water mainly. I mean, you washed and shaved in cold water. Then it was down to breakfast.
Did you shave?
Yeah. Down to breakfast with your mess cans to have breakfast, which was quite substantial. I mean, the food in the army was pretty good.
The food as a whole, you know, so we don't keep coming back to it. What was the food like?
It was pretty good. I mean, it was palatable. Reasonably well presented, it wasn't thrown at you, and I mean, eating out mess cans was never sort of what I would term the height of luxury, but no, the food was reasonable.
And it was the normal sort of just standard food for
yeah,
the day, I mean,
yeah.
British standard.
Yeah,
diet.
Yeah, like breakfast was porridge, bread, jam, slab of margarine, that was it basically. I don't think there was a lot of hot food for breakfast other than porridge, if I remember. We always used to cook meal for lunch if we were in camp, unless we were out sort of a rifle range or whatever.
And what would that be?
Could be stew with vegetables, potatoes and so on. A piece of plum duff with some custard perhaps, and a mug of tea.
And in the evening?
Full of maybe with a bit of bromide in to make sure. Evening meal would be sort of a light evening meal. We usually used to top up with about one or tuppence worth in the naffy, you know, sort of baked beans on toast with a few chips and so on.
Now, this bromide business, is that a rumour?
No, I
think
I was pretty confident. The tea always tastes of it. I don't care what anybody says, there was definitely bromide in the tea.
And that was meant to, I mean, because people won't know, what was that meant to do?
Meant to dampen your ardour, I think, to keep your sexual desires suppressed.
And do you think it worked?
Well, certainly did for me, yeah.
get back into the thing. Back after breakfast.
After breakfast, it was typical. It was drill.
Drill. Had you done any drill before?
No, I'd not been a cadet.
So you weren't in the OTC then?
No, so it was straight into drill. I took to quite well. Some youngsters didn't. It was amazing, a number of two or three that always used to swing the same arm, the same leg together and just could not learn how to march. But we were drilled.